Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the first quarter 2019 SilverCrest Market Commentary conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Mr. Robert Teeter. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, and thanks to everyone for dialing in this afternoon. I'm Robert Teeter, and I'm joined by Patrick Shovanec. We welcome you to our call this afternoon. One of the things that we've noticed as we look back, and I'm sure you all noticed as well, it was quite a rocky road for markets in the fourth quarter, actually nearly touching a 20% decline, which folks typically define as a bear market. When we think back to that period of time, there were no shortage of issues that were on the forefront of discussion as to what was the purported cause for the decline in stocks. One of these seemed to be that recession was entering the dialogue, or concerns of a recession. While the case for recession seemed to be at least a bit weak, as reported in the popular press, it set the backdrop for Patrick's quarterly letter, where he spent a lot of time conducting a deep dive into a variety of different recession indicators and spending a lot of time assessing whether or not these actually work and what they were telling us today. Now, markets have since recovered about half or more of that decline, but this topic is still a very worthwhile one. We are certainly in the later years of the economic recovery, and while many pieces of research point to the fact that when you go through a significant contraction or recession as we did in the financial crisis, that the recovery tends to be longer-lived, there's certainly no reason why we shouldn't be paying close attention to the economy and to any signs of recession and whether or not they're perking up. The other reason this topic is really timely and very interesting is that a key component of our base case all along has been that absent recession or inflation, stocks ought to track earnings and dividends higher. That tends to be the case historically. It's tended to be the case recently. So we've got our eyes pretty closely tuned to whether or not there are any developments that would increase the probability or odds of a recession. So with that, we'll turn into some of the topics that Patrick addressed in his quarterly with regard to a number of different indicators. His work was along the lines of seeing whether these indicators were, in fact, indicative of pending or upcoming recession, but also to assess where these indicators are today to give us some sense of where we are in the cycle. But before we dive into the meatier topics, I thought I'd first just ask Patrick a quick question. In the technology industry, there's a concept of an Easter egg or sort of a hidden message, and it seems to be that there's a bit of a hidden message in your letter that I thought you might want to share with those who dialed in today.
Oh, no, I just, the first line, "A specter is haunting markets, the specter of recession," if that sounds familiar to people at all from their college days, that's actually the opening line of the Communist Manifesto, which is, "The specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism." So yes, it is a little bit of an Easter egg for those paying attention, but it also seemed accurate in terms of what was happening in December, that there was this shadow that was hanging over markets that we wanted to kind of get to the bottom of what was really casting that shadow. And they say that markets climb, bull markets climb a wall of worry, and that's true. There have been worries all along throughout this recovery, but we also don't want to dismiss worries that when they have real merit. And there's been no lack of headlines recently of things to worry about, whether it be Brexit or a government shutdown lasting however long it might last, or trade negotiations and the prospect of a trade war with China, or a slowing China, or a slowing Europe. So many of these things have been in the headlines and sort of contributed to this narrative that was taking place at the end of the year of, I heard so many people, and I'm not just talking about talking heads, but people who I listen to, who I respect, who I think are thoughtful people, saying, "You know what? I kind of feel like it's the end of the cycle." And as much as I respect intuition, and intuition can be useful sometimes, I thought that what we really need to do, given all those kind of gut feels, was go and say, okay, so objectively, what are the signs that usually signal a coming recession and the end of a cycle? And how many of them are we seeing? And I entered on the project really without a preconception of saying, it's nothing to worry about, or yes, we will see that, you know, all these things are happening. But the result was, when I looked at them, that except for a handful that, you know, might look like they were things to watch, most of them were saying no. Most of them were saying that the things that we normally see going into recession are not happening.
Great. Well, that's a fantastic backdrop to just dive right in, I think. And as I looked through a number of the indicators in your letter, and I mentioned this to you earlier, it seemed to me that there were four or five that I think are very popularly talked about, and perhaps some misconceptions about how they're interpreted and how they're used. So why don't we start with the first one, which you listed first, the yield curve, which is certainly talked about a lot. And I think you came across some interesting findings, both in terms of its efficacy, but also in terms of things that happen between the period of time when the yield curve inverts and when a recession might be starting.
So if you hadn't heard about the yield curve before December, you probably did, because there was all the talk about the prospect of the yield curve inverting, or a partial inversion in the yield curve, and that is a very reliable recession indicator. It is true that an inverted yield curve, that is, when short-term rates rise higher than long-term rates, or longer-term rates fall lower than short-term rates, and you get a negative slope to the yield curve, that is actually a very reliable predictor of recession coming at some point. And the reason why is, you know, logically you think it through, is it basically what the bond market is saying is that they expect the Fed to go into rate cutting mode at some point, which would be a reflection of a recession taking place. But the important thing is this, that first of all, we don't have a fully inverted yield curve yet. That's the first thing to recognize. And for all the talk about it, it didn't happen. And I'll talk about a little bit about what the partially inverted yield curve might mean. But we did not see a fully inverted yield curve, as would typically indicate a coming recession. But even then, there's often a long lead time, as long as 2 years, until between the time when the yield curve inverts and then the recession takes place. And so it's not an indicator of, okay, you know, everybody out of the pool because the cycle's over. It's significant, but even if it were to happen tomorrow, that would mean, you know, on average, that we'd be looking at a recession sometime in the latter half of 2020. It could happen sooner, but that on average would be the case. And then what happens in the meantime is interesting, because you would presume that, okay, everybody sees that, well, there's a clear indicator of recession coming, so markets are going to anticipate that, and, you know, you're going to have a bear market before that. Not at all the case that in many instances, not all, but in many instances, you actually see double-digit gains after the yield curve inverts, up to the point before the recession hits, or the, you know, the market peaks before the recession. So, you know, it's not something where you can just look at the yield curve and say, okay, our market outlook can be based on what the yield curve is telling us, because it's a very early indicator, and a lot can happen between the point where the yield curve inverts and you might miss a significant chunk of the bull market, you know, if you just take that as an indicator to, okay, it's time to get out.
Right. And maybe just loop back to a second, you touched on it briefly, but just to, you know, walk through the sort of partial inversion.
Yes. So what happened was the one-year yield climbed up higher than the 2 and 3 year, and I think at one point maybe the 5 year yield. The 10 year never went below. So there was always overall a positive slope to the yield curve, but there was kind of this kink to the curve where it went up and then it went down and then it went and what that indicated to me, I gave a lot of thought, like, okay, what is this implying? What it seemed to be implying was that the Fed, the market believed that the Fed was going to make a mistake, that the Fed was going to raise rates one too many times this year, and then they would turn around and have to undo that very soon afterwards, which suggests that, you know, the Fed's going to make a mistake and then it's going to kick us into recession. But then the Fed came out in December and, you know, a number of different people from the Fed basically said, we're patient. We're under no pressure from inflation to rush ahead and raise rates. And we may well just, you know, we're going to be data driven. We're not on any kind of a schedule for raising rates. And what we've seen since then is that the yield curve hasn't completely unkinked, but a lot of that has been removed. And so the bet that the market was making that the Fed's going to make a mistake, policy mistake, and, you know, drive the economy into recession, that has eased off a lot given what the Fed has said.
Right. Great. Well, why don't we shift maybe from interest rates and the Fed to the consumer, which, as you highlight, and it's an important fact for people to keep in mind, that household spending accounts for 69% of the U.S. economy. So consumer confidence would seemingly play a really important role in the economy and any indications of pending recession. So if you could walk through what you found there, that would be helpful.
So what I found was that it was actually a very good indicator. I always knew it was kind of listed as a leading indicator, but in a deep dive, it was one of the most reliable, which is one of the reasons why I had it up front, that you do see significant declines in consumer confidence in the immediate, you know, let's say the six-month period before a recession, which is in contrast to where consumer confidence has been, which is it's been very strong and near the top of its game for the cycle through December. Now, we had a reading in January from University of Michigan that was a significant drop and put us back to, I think, I can't remember. I mean, it was like an 8 or 9 point drop, and it put us back to at least the lowest in a year or two. A lot of that has to be due to the government shutdown, and how short lived that will be, you know, whether that's a hiccup or whether that's a new trend, that's pretty important, because if the government shutdown continues indefinitely and that continues to gnaw at consumer confidence, then you could see that's, you know, normally I advise, as you know, when this shutdown began, I said, normally shutdowns don't have a big economic impact. Or if they do have an economic impact, it tends to be transient, and you get a slowdown in consumption and then you get a bump in consumption when everybody gets paid what they were owed. But the longer it goes on, the more serious of a shock to consumer confidence that it implies. And so, you know, we see today even indications that maybe they might be heading towards a deal that could solve it. Maybe, I don't know what that would look like. Nobody in Washington knows what that will look like. But I think that there's a growing realization that we're, you know, this is like third. We're into the 30s, 32-day, 33-day, whatever,
yeah.
And that the economic consequences are becoming more serious and more real, and therefore there's more pressure to put an end to it. And so, you know, we'll be looking very closely at whether consumer confidence then recovers.
Yeah, I think that it's worthwhile to keep a close eye on both, as you note, for weather and how the shutdown is resolved.
Because it has been extremely strong.
Yeah.
And showing none of the typical signs that you would see before a recession of a fall off.
And you'll probably also get some movement in it based on the fact that stocks had been down quite a bit more, recovered somewhat. So keep a close eye on that one. I don't want to jump around too much, and I want to be aware of time and Q&A and things, but another indicator that you looked at that I think would be great to dive into a little bit is the inventory to sales ratio. You know, historically, the boom-bust cycle has been one that's been a cause of recession, and so I think it's noteworthy that you took a look at that and be worthwhile to talk through your findings.
It's not something that always precedes a recession, but it can cause a recession in the sense that you've had, you know, too much inventory build up and then there's a pullback. That was something that I was quite concerned about 2 years ago, and it's actually a good opportunity to talk about. 2 years ago, I wrote a quarterly note at the beginning of the year that talked about the prospect of a recession in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than say, well, I guess we were wrong, it's interesting in retrospect how right we were to be concerned about certain things that we were seeing, that there were many more of these 9 recession indicators for flashing,
yeah,
at least yellow,
right,
at that time than are right now. And inventory to sales was one of them. There was a big inventory to sales buildup. It had reached, you know, kind of concerning levels. It's fallen back since then. It has ticked up a bit in recent months, but not anywhere close to where it was.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something we, you know, continue to watch. It's a little bit elevated compared to historical trends. But it's something which has actually gotten better rather than getting worse over the past 2 years.
Right. Interesting. I know that in prior monthly letters and quarterlies, and also again here in the piece on recession indicators, ISM surveys, and I think there's some interesting things to probe there, both in terms of the number and its relevance for recession, but also just in regard to some of the comments that have been coming through in the comments section that you've been passing along.
So, you know, the ISM surveys are soft data in the sense that they reflect just a survey of what people are thinking, in this case, purchasing managers. And there are two different surveys, manufacturing and non-manufacturing, and they have some subcomponents which give an indication of, particularly new orders, gives sort of a leading indication of where things might be heading. 2 years ago, the ISM manufacturing number went into contraction for several months, and there was talk around that time of, is this an indication of a recession? And it was actually an indication of a manufacturing recession, perhaps, an earnings recession, because we did see earnings go down in 2016, but not an overall economic recession. Economic recessions tend to be, you know, so manufacturing is only a relatively small part of the economy, although a significant one. And a much broader indicator, much broader survey is the ISM non-manufacturing, which covers a much larger portion of the economy, but has a much shorter history. So it's harder to make sort of broad historical lessons from what's happened. But what has happened in the last 2 recessions has been that both of them have gone down. There are a lot of times when the manufacturing index goes below 50, which is contraction, without actually causing recession. But when they both go into contraction, or both look like they're trending towards contraction, that's when you probably need to be alarmed. Now, what's it look like? They've both been really strong until December. Nowhere close to what would be a recession indicator, quite the contrary. Up around 60, which is really strong expansion territory. Manufacturing came in surprisingly low in December, and also new orders really showed a significant pullback, which got a lot of people's attention, and should.
Mm-hmm.
But it still is above the sort of typical danger zone that would signify a recession. But it's something to watch. You know, if that continues to weaken, if we see more indications, and, you know, there's also in these surveys qualitative responses that are given. And for a while now, they said really strong economic growth, really strong demand, but we're worried about tariffs. That's what they said for like the last half year. In December, they started to say we're starting to see slowdown in demand. If that continues, that's something which we need to keep an eye on. But so far, we're not anywhere close in the overall readings to what would signal coming recession.
Mm-hmm.
We also saw a bit of a weakening in non-manufacturing as well, but interestingly, no weakening in new orders, which remain very strong. So, you know, new orders tells you a little bit about what to expect from those numbers, you know, a couple months out. And again, you know, unless we see continued weakening in those numbers, I'm not too worried. But it is something to keep an eye on because they had been really strong and they showed up much weaker in December.
Right. Good. Any other items of the indicators either that you talked about or things that perhaps you looked at and decided not to comment on because they were not as relevant as you might have deemed, or any other findings from your research that would be worthwhile to know?
Well, you know, one thing that a lot of people talk about is commodity prices. You know, there's the old expression, Dr. Copper tells you what, you know, diagnoses the economy. And what I found was that really may have been true, you know, in the early 20th century or the 19th century. But it doesn't really tell, now that the United States has become largely a service economy, it tells you something, but it probably tells you more about China than it tells you about the United States. And, of course, China is a valid concern, second largest economy in the world. But I have a little bit different take than most people about what a slowing China means for the U.S. economy. I don't think that there's a direct translation between slowing Chinese economy and slowing U.S. economy, because a lot of what has driven Chinese economic growth has been expansion in capacity, investment, and I would argue overinvestment, which has really flooded the world with, you know, competitive goods and been a deflationary force for outputs. It's been inflationary for inputs, you know, like oil or like copper, but deflationary for a lot of our own industries, right? Makes it hard for us to have pricing power globally. And the result of a slowdown, or, you know, an end of China's overinvestment boom, is actually to relieve a lot of pressure on a lot of U.S. industries. So, you know, just like, you know, people, and I think it's hard for people to kind of wrap their minds around the idea of, well, if the second and largest economy in the world slows, isn't that bad for the rest of the world economy? Well, it depends on whether that growth was, what kind of growth that growth was feeding in the rest of the world.
Right.
If it was just simply feeding, you know, commodities which were flowing into overinvestment and then creating overcapacity in the global economy, that wasn't good for the rest of the world. It was actually negative for the rest of the world. And it wasn't really driving demand, the kind of demand that we need to see, sustainable end-user demand. In the 1990s, Japan, which was another surplus country, another country which was, you know, creating a lot of capacity, exporting a lot of capacity, they went from being one of the fastest-growing economies in the world to one of the slowest-growing economies in the world. It did not derail the rest of the global economy because they were not driving the rest of the world's economic growth.
Right.
So I think the same is true of China. And in many ways, we should welcome a slowdown in China in terms of its output. One of the things that's true about China is that China has produced more than it's consumed for many years. It can afford to consume more than it produces. So as output growth slows in China, they're going to see the need to prop up standards of living in their country. And that is actually going to translate into net demand globally. So I'm not trying to paint a too rosy of a picture of what a slowdown in China means, but it's an economic adjustment that needs to take place and will actually be healthy for the rest of the global economy. So, you know, when people point to things like oil or they point to copper as an indicator of future economic growth, you've got to ask what kind of economic growth and where is it actually giving an indication of.
Right. Great. Well, one of the things that I think is fantastic about that point, and indeed the entire letter, is that it really highlights two concepts. One is that nothing is as easy or as simple as it seems in the jobs that we and others have as investors. And the second is that, you know, both data and sentiment are important, but it's important to separate the two and recognize what you're looking at. And I think when you went through the exercise of looking at these indicators and really trying to take a very clear-eyed look at what they meant and what they didn't mean, I think that was a really helpful guidepost that we all take into consideration when we're setting our asset allocation and other things like that. So with that, and mindful of the time and knowing that we like to keep a fairly crisp call here on the quarterlies, we'd like to turn it back to the moderator for any questions that might be on the line.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, that's star, then one to ask a question. To prevent any background noise, we ask that you please place your line on mute once your question has been stated. And as a reminder, that's star, then one to ask a question. If you have a question at this time, you can press star, then one. And I'm not showing any questions in the queue.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us, and we look forward to hosting you again next quarter.
And actually, pardon me, gentlemen, we do have two in the queue. Oh. Would you like to go forward?
Okay. Absolutely.
Perfect. Our first question comes from Marvin Burkett. Your line is now open.
Hello?
Marvin Burkett, your line is now open.
Hi. Sorry, Patrick.
Hi.
Patrick, I got a question for you. This is Mark Burkett.
Yes,
hey,
hi.
What's the downside on this Brexit fiasco? What should indicators should we look for in all of this?
Well, Europe is already slowing, so that is an area of real concern. It's quite possible, you know, Germany had negative GDP growth in the third quarter. Given some very disappointing industrial output numbers from Germany in December, it's quite possible that we'll have a negative fourth quarter in Germany, which would be Germany is in recession. So, you know, the weakness in Europe is something to take seriously. Brexit has the potential to aggravate that.
I don't think it, in,
you know, without looking at other indicators, I wouldn't necessarily say, okay, well, that translates into a recession for the United States. I think, you know, one thing that maybe we didn't really fully articulate in the previous conversation is that the U.S. economy is slowing, you know, and I think that's part of what the growth is slowing, the rate of growth is slowing, whether it's you know, GDP growth that's anticipated for 2019 or whether it's the earnings growth. You know, we had phenomenal earnings growth last year on the back of a corporate tax cut and on the back of a lot of corporate buybacks. So earnings per share was up quite a bit. We're not going to see a repetition of that. But that doesn't then translate into a recession or negative growth, whether it's in GDP growth or whether it's in earnings. And so I would say that, you know, Brexit, I don't have any more idea. I don't think anybody, again, just like with this government shutdown, I don't think anybody in London or Brussels has a clue what's going to happen. If I was forced to bet, I would say they're going to delay it. And they're going to kick it down the road about 6 months, and they're going to say, you know, we hold out hope of an agreement, and that's not a hard Brexit, but we're still sticking to Brexit, and maybe we'll have another referendum, who knows. And who knows what the result of that would be. But it's going to get kicked down the road. I would be very surprised if we get to, you know, March 29th, and we're just facing a hard Brexit, and that's what happens. And maybe some of the weakness that we see in Europe also lends itself to a willingness to do that as well.
Very good.
Thank you. And the next question comes from Mark Farah, private investor. Your line is now open.
Hi. I was wondering if you could comment on your view on equity valuations, kind of both domestic and overseas, and if you feel comfortable doing so, comment on how you incorporate kind of cyclically adjusted Shiller PE valuation numbers into your calculus.
Yeah, sure. Hi, Mark. It's Rob. I'll address that and let Patrick fill in some gaps as he sees fit as well. You know, with regard to U.S. equity valuation, I think, you know, we and others for some time have been aware that valuations were in the upper deciles and quartiles and whatever ranking mechanism you'd like to use versus history. Although I think we had a slightly different view in that if you take a longer-term historical perspective, you realize that a lot of those valuations that go into the averages were in an environment of much higher inflation and much higher interest rates. And so you rewind the clock maybe 6 months or so, I think we thought valuations were perhaps a bit elevated, but supported by those factors. If you jump forward to today, what we've seen is valuations have come down quite a bit. And while earnings growth next year may not be quite as robust, and certainly won't be quite as robust as it has been in the past year, earnings have grown quite soundly, and with stocks being off their highs a bit, valuations have come in considerably. And so I think that sets the stage for a fairly constructive outlook going forward. At sort of the near the bottom for stocks when they were at their lows a few weeks back, there was some math put out there, which I happen to generally agree with, by J.P. Morgan, which talked about the change in valuation set the stage for an extra 3% or so per year of returns on top of whatever your expectations were otherwise. And I think that's fairly reasonable. I'll touch on the Shiller point for a sec. One thing that's interesting about those numbers, and I think it'll be important for us and others to pay attention going forward in the next couple of quarters, is that I believe those are based on a 10-year look back. And we tried to model forward what happens as you roll off some of the recession numbers. And I think those metrics improve a little bit as well. And so, anyway, boiling that all down, I would say that we come to sort of the same point we were before, which is that you could say that valuations are a bit higher than long-term averages. At one point during the decline here a few weeks ago, they actually dropped below historical averages. So I think they're not as much of a concern as they were a month or two ago. But even then, again, supported by, decent earnings outlook, stable economy, and not a real risk of inflation at that point in time. The last part of your question, and I'll let Patrick add in things that I may have missed, was on U.S. versus international. And there, too, I think a lot of folks have been pounding the table that international is quite a bit cheaper. I think as Patrick noted there in his comments, it's maybe for potentially for good reason in some segments of Europe with the softening economy and other issues. But when you look at those numbers, you again have to look at them in historical context. And I think if you go back across a pretty broad swath of time, valuations outside the U.S. typically do average between 65 and 75% of U.S. valuations, which is around where they are now. So there is a dispersion there, but one that tends to be in place, and sometimes for good reasons. I think there are some complexities involved in investing abroad. There are situations in terms of whether or not shareholders are treated well and macro perspectives and things like that. So no doubt there is a valuation gap. Maybe selectively there's some opportunity. We certainly invest globally. We invest with managers. We're putting some money to work overseas with what we think are great companies at good valuations. So I do think there's some opportunity there, but not just based on a simple valuation argument. So.
Yeah, I'll add to that and say that I think it's, a common mistake that people make to compare a P.E. ratio in one market with the P.E. ratio in another and say, well, okay, one is cheaper than the other. Because there are lots of differences that need to be taken into account, some of them having to do with accounting in some cases, some of them having to do with risk premium that may or may not really be appropriate, that Rob mentioned. Also just the mix of industries. If you look at, certain industries will have a high PE ratio and others will have a low. And if you have an economy with a very different mix of industries, you should have a different PE ratio.
Right.
It's actually more useful to compare each market with its own historical benchmarks and then say, okay, what do we think?
Right.
What do we think about what's happening in an economy and what does this valuation make sense? As opposed to simply saying, one's a 20 and another's a 17, and obviously buy the 17 because that's cheaper. Speaking of risk premium, I'll also add something that is in my quarterly, so I won't try to summarize it in full, but basically, when we look at valuations, it's also relative to what's your alternative, and the fact that you have very, very low interest rates around the world has to be weighed against what equity valuations should be. Something that may look expensive, in one situation doesn't quite look as expensive in another. So One thing that we've been, you know, talking about over the course of the past couple of years has been the equity risk premium, and I mentioned it in this note. And given the, you know, the downturn in the market over the past couple months, the equity risk premium has popped back up to 6% at the end of December. That is well above its historical average of 4.2%. And what that implies is that a lot of risk adversity is being priced into this market. And if you go back historically, as I did, and say, okay, when their equity risk premium was above 5%, what were typically the 5-year annual, you know, annual returns over the next 5 years versus when the equity risk premium was at or below 3.4%. And the difference was between, you know, 11% when you had a high equity risk premium versus 3% when you had a low equity risk premium. So the equity risk premium won't tell you whether the market will be down or up next year. Okay? But it might tell you, or it certainly has told you over the past, you know, 50 years or so, that when you have a high equity risk premium, when you have a lot of fear being priced into the market, at some point over the next 5 years, usually that fear, something happens, maybe it's the end of the cycle, in the beginning of a new cycle, that fear gets priced out, and you get to actually end up with above average returns, no matter where you started. So whether or not there's going to be a recession next year or not, so much fear of a recession is being priced into the market relative to, you know, interest rates, that equities are still relatively attractively priced for a long-term investor, as long as that long-term investor can afford what's, you know, the fear that's being priced in, which is fear of volatility, fear of going through the end of the cycle. But if you can afford that, if you don't have to worry about where your, you know, what your portfolio looks like at the end of the year, you only worry about what it looks like 5 years from now. To the extent that that's true, the equity risk premium suggests that equities are attractively priced.
Thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Happy to chat with you further too as well. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you, and I'm not showing any further questions in the queue.
Great. Well, thank you everyone for dialing in this afternoon, and we look forward to hosting you again next quarter.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude today's program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone have a great day.